there's no such thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Ronan Krauts, Israeli ambassador to Azerbaijan. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Shows and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and a happy secular new year. On this first Too Jewish show of 2026, I find myself reflecting on the last year, and I cannot help but think about how complicated it was for Jews everywhere, in Israel, here in the United States, and elsewhere around the world. 2025 followed two extremely challenging years. 2023, when the horrific war crime attack of Hamas murdered 1,200 people, Israelis, Americans, Brits, French, Thais, Nepalese, and the citizens of many other nations, and raped and tortured and committed arson and other atrocities, including the inhuman taking of 250 hostages, all of which caused the Gaza War. After 2023, we really didn't think things could get much worse. But then 2024 contributed a massively rising anti-Semitic trend all over the world, with mass protests and campus occupations and so many more assaults on Jewish life and our feelings of security. Frankly, that all started back in 2023 as soon as those Palestinian murderous terrorists began killing Jews, and long before Israel even started a military response. Most distressing, perhaps, in 2024 was the huge anti-Zionist and, frankly, rabidly anti-Semitic character that was so prevalent all over college campuses here in the U.S. and Canada and, of course, on social media. So, what can we say about 2025? Well, it was kind of a mixed bag. First, what happened in Israel over the last year has been complex, challenging, disturbing, inspiring, and very messy. Israel has been whipsawed emotionally, politically, militarily, and nearly every other way. Over just the last 12 months, its people have agonized about the hostages still brutally held in Gaza by the Palestinians, experienced the ongoing campaign vilifying Israel for continuing to fight that war against the Hamas Palestinian terrorists of Gaza, and continue to be engaged in suppressing terrorism in Lebanon and countering the Islamist massacres perpetrated against the Druze in Syria. Israel has been attacked by and fought and won a successful air, missile, and drone war against Iran, saw Iranian missiles hit and kill Israeli civilians, and everyone in the country, more or less, at some point had to take refuge in safe rooms and shelters. And then Israel agreed to a ceasefire with Hamas in exchange for the return of the remaining hostages held by the Palestinian terrorists, and Israel withdrew its troops to a buffer area around Gaza, and then watched Hamas try to reestablish itself as the power to fear in Gaza. Societally, Israel has gone from a profound focus on the return of the hostages to the reality of their return and the end of the more than two-year nightmare of that collective vigil. It was quite a year, and there was more, of course, but in any case, it ends with Israel and Israelis in a better position than they were at the start of 2025, certainly, but suffering from a kind of collective PTSD. Recovering from all of that to some level of normalcy will certainly take some time. For we Jews here in America, in 2025, we saw active pushback by the U.S. government against this virulent campaign against Zionism, Israel, and Jews, at least as long as that anti-Semitic hostility had come from the left of the political spectrum. That's resulted in some dramatic changes on college campuses, a backlash against the encampment movement with its overt anti-Semitism, and a counterweight to the generic Jew-blaming and Jew-shaming that invaded American culture during the Gaza War. This year has also seen the deliberate use of the charge of anti-Semitism, or of the failure to adequately respond to openly anti-Semitic situations, as a kind of weapon wielded by this U.S. administration in order to attack what it perceives to be its enemies on the opposite end of the political spectrum, and of course, intellectuals. And we've seen a number of violent attacks on Jews in the U.S. just over the past year. Meanwhile, on the right wing of American politics, a raging debate somehow exists right now over whether virulent conspiracy theorist anti-Semites like Candace Owens and Nick Fuentes and the lamentable Tucker Carlson should hold influence over the direction of that political party. Oh, but it has been worse outside the U.S., in fact. All around the world, Jews have experienced a steady stream of anti-Semitic attacks, many of them cloaked in the anti-Israel or anti-Zionist colors adopted by Jew haters everywhere. That's resulted in horrible anti-Semitic fatal violence perpetrated by Islamists in places as disparate as Manchester, England at Yom Kippur and Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia at the start of Hanukkah just 2 weeks ago today. The frequency and lethality of these attacks mark 2025 as one of the most anti-Semitic in recent memory. The end of the Gaza War makes it clear that these terrorist murders are not about Israel or Zionism. They're simply about the evil goal of murdering Jews, as many Jews as possible, and that this is a theological choice made by those who adhere to the Muslim Brotherhood Islamist ideology of hate. Now, I don't want to say that everything about 2025 was bad for the Jews, or Israel, or here in America, or around the world. That simply isn't true. Jewish life in Israel, the United States, and the broader diaspora remains active, vital, creative, and energized. I suppose every year is a mixed bag, some good, some awful. We look forward to this brand spanking new year of 2026 proving to be better. To play us in this morning on the subject of the recurrence of anti-Semitism everywhere, here's an exceptionally clever song about how people on the left and people on the right both like to, well, blame the Jews. It's by a talented Australian group that pulls no punches called Hakol Sababa, which is Hebrew for it's all cool or it's all fantastic, more or less. This song is
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4!
Blackout and a frown, says the world's on fire, but she can't put it down. Landlords, greedy daddies mean the Wi-Fi's slow. There must be someone pulling strings behind the show. She scrolls all night, the rabbit hole gets deep. Found a grainy meme that never lets her sleep. When your life's a mess and you're feeling rather small, we got the perfect cure to make you 10 feet tall. Losers, grifters, basket cases, every color, every creed, all the angry faces. Whatever's wrong in your life, it's the Jews,
it's the Jews.
Feel better now, don't you? Griper in his bedroom, Pepe on the wall, says the West has fallen and he's gonna take the fall. Girlfriend left him for a bloke who has a job. Globalists did it with their evil bank rob. He's got the charts, the graphs, the triple brackets too. 14 words and 88 will see him through. When your life's a mess and you're feeling rather small, we've got the perfect cure to make you 10 feet tall. Losers, grifters, basket cases, every color, every creed, all the angry faces. Whatever's wrong in your life, it ain't you. It's the Jews,
it's the Jews.
Blame it on the Jews,
it's the Jews, it's the Jews.
Feel better now, don't you?
We'll be right back. the well went bad, the crops all failed, and the priest was mad. The plague came rolling through the town. Quick, find a scapegoat, drag him down. Blood libel, matzah, all the old cliches, still doing numbers in 2025 ways.
Hey! Imam on the telly, veins popping in his neck, says the Zionists control the weather. What the heck? Hamas lost again, the rocket misfired, must be Mossad with a secret wire. From Tehran to Toxteph, same old tune, different century, still howling at the moon. Losers, grifters, basket cases, every color, every creed, all the angry faces. Whatever's wrong in your life, it ain't you, it's the juice.
It's the juice.
Blame it on the juice.
It's the juice.
It's the juice. Feel better now, don't you?
That was the group Hakol Sababa, the Australian band that, after Bondi Beach, has had direct evidence of the fact that blaming the Jews is part and parcel of the anti-Semitic playbook being used right now. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest this morning will be the extraordinarily articulate Ronan Krauss, the Israeli ambassador to the country of Azerbaijan. He'll explain the origins of the relationship between the two nations and its importance for the whole region when we come back in a moment on To Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Ronan Krauss is Israel's ambassador to Azerbaijan, a role he's had for, I guess it's about 5 years now. It's a really fascinating and interesting relationship, and he has been a professional diplomat with a number of important postings. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Shalom, shalom. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I want to note, we had the pleasure of having dinner at your home with some of your lovely family, your wife and one child. You've been in Azerbaijan for a while. It's puzzling to people when I talk about the fact that this Shia Muslim nation has a close relationship with Israel. Can you talk about the evolution of that relationship?
Yes, definitely. So I totally agree that the relations between Israel and Azerbaijan are a unique example for how relations between Israel as a Jewish state should be with a predominantly Muslim country. That's how they like to describe Azerbaijan, since they have more than 95% Islamic population, contains both Shia and minority of Sunni. The relations have started many years ago, more than 30 years ago, the beginning of the 90s. Immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Azerbaijan gained its independence, and Israel was one of the first countries to recognize Azerbaijan as an independent state. And from that moment on, due to the understanding of leaders from way back, from that era, President Peres, the late President Haider Aliyev, They managed to create a bond, a true bond between both countries, which were based on mutual respect and mutual assistance. Azerbaijan was immediately after they gained their independence. They were involved in a very violent war with Armenia over the Karabakh region, in which they lost. And they have searched for countries to support them, and Israel was there. And since then, it has developed for the last 30 years, more than 30 years, until these days. And the relations continue to grow and to expand and to break more and more into new venues of cooperation. If we started at the beginning with support, political support and also defense support, it moved on to energy. Today, 60%, or around 60% of Israel's consumption of oil is coming from Azerbaijan. And we have increased more and more fields of the cooperation, which vary between sectors such as cybersecurity, agriculture, water technologies, tourism, and many others. And I believe that the future holds many more venues of cooperation, which we still need to fulfill.
We will talk much more with Ambassador Ronan Krauss of Israel when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established 7 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the Metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests at all times. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious schools available at Beit Simcha for the brand new semester for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Torah Tykes experience for the youngest kids, bar and bat mitzvah programs, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with wonderful Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. BeitSimcha Tucson.org. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are always open to everybody. Join us Friday night or Saturday morning. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m., followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat. Saturday morning Torah study is at 9 a.m., services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can come to services also on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson, or come to our classes on Zoom. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught in person and on Zoom. You can find out about them. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tykes, Bar Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, Ritual of Adult Education Academy courses, Taste of Judaism, all taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470.
888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, there have been some really awful plots that have either been foiled or unfortunately have murdered Jews in a variety of places around the world quite recently in the last couple of weeks. In Sydney, Australia, at the Bondi Beach massacre at Hanukkah, in Toronto, Canada, and Quebec, where they thwarted attempts to commit mass murder against Jews. In the northwest of England, where they just convicted a couple of guys after the Manchester, actually the trial came around the same time as the Yom Kippur attack that killed people there.
And Providence, Rhode Island, and Brookline, Massachusetts.
Providence, Rhode Island. And we could make the list. And these are all places where Jews, frankly, have felt pretty comfortable and confident for a long time. What's going on?
Well, I don't think there's any easy answer to that question. More Jews have the feeling that no place is safe, and that the old saying that we comforted ourselves with, that it can't happen here, is a saying that Jews in Germany used in the 1930s, and they were just flat out wrong. And now I think Jews in countries like the U.S. and Canada, Australia, are having second thoughts about that assumption. And it used to be that Israel was ultimately the Tel Aviv, the land of asylum, for the safe place for Jews. But now it seems less that way ever since October 7th because of external enemies and attacks from the outside, but also because of disorder in Israel, to put it mildly. Israel is not the safe refuge that it once was. And I think there are a lot of Jews around the world who are very anxious about, well, what's our ultimate fallback position? Where do we go?
Right.
Greenland?
Portugal, I've heard, which is ironic since we mostly were expelled from there in the 16th century.
Right.
Look, it wouldn't be the first time that we didn't have anywhere to go that felt safe. There's a famous Yiddish song, Hin Soll Ich Gehen, I think is, where should we go? Or the Fishula, about there's a Yiddish story song about the Jews like the fish chased by bigger fish all around. And then at the end of the Fishula, he comes to Tzion, you know, they come to Israel and they're safe. It becomes a kind of a positive statement about the Jewish homeland. After October 7th, 2023, after all the wars, the Ring of Fire, all of that, yes, Israel has succeeded in these wars, but there's been a cost. It does seem really, really like the worst time not that all Jews aren't doing, by and large, okay most places, but it doesn't seem safe. Are we exaggerating this too much?
I don't think so. I mean, if you just look at the past 12 months, there's an unprecedented number of violent events that are either against Israel or against Jews or the Jewish people as a whole. Some of this is being anti-Western. Jews, ironically, have come to personify the West for Islamists and sort of Islamic extremists. And, you know, you've heard me say this before, but I'll say it again because something this true deserves repetition. We tend to confuse and Muslims. And there are plenty of Arabs who are not Muslim, and there are plenty of Muslims, in fact, the vast majority of Muslims, who are not Arabs. They're Pakistanis or Iranians or Indonesians or Bangladeshi, whatever they are. But none of those people is Arab. And forget that the animus doesn't come specifically from Arabs, but from Islamic people throughout the world.
Well, I guess I'll say I hope it turns out to be better in 2026 than it has been over the last, I would say, 2 or 3 years.
Make a look home today.
Halavai. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Introducing Taste of Judaism, offering everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but never got to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? What do Jews believe about life after death? Where does the concept of Brit Covenant come from? In 3 upbeat, fun, inexpensive, informative sessions, Taste of Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. You'll study with Rabbi Sam Kohan and learn what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about, and have a great sample of delicious Jewish foods. Classes are offered at La Cholla and Tangerine in Oro Valley, and all classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, Taste of Judaism is offered free of charge, but you must pre-register. No cost to you, and the learning is invaluable. Free, but you must pre-register by calling 520-276-5676 or emailing execbeitsimcha@gmail.com or going to www.beitsimcha.tucson.org and signing up. Hundreds of thousands of students worldwide have taken Taste of Judaism. Why not join them? No obligation, just an energetic and great instructor, free food, fun, and a wonderful introduction to Jewish life. Call 520-276-5675 to register for Taste of Judaism, the most popular and effective introduction to Jewish learning and life. Call 520-276-5675 for your very own Taste of Judaism.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. What's the difference between a Jewish pessimist and a Jewish optimist? The Jewish pessimist says, things can't get any worse. The Jewish optimist says, sure they can. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Exodus, second book of the Torah, with a great portion of Shmot, one of the really most spectacular Torah portions of all. It starts with a kind of coda on Genesis, recounting how the first family of Bereishit, Jacob and his many sons and their descendants, all moved down to Egypt, where Joseph, Jacob's son, is the effective ruler of the country. They settle in Goshen, in northeastern Egypt, the Delta, and flourish there. And then the fateful events that set up the future of our people begin. Joseph and all his generation pass away. A new dynasty takes over in Egypt, which doesn't remember Joseph or his contributions. The Israelites are now viewed differently. As they grow in numbers and wealth, the new pharaoh worries. These immigrants might serve as a fifth column in the event of invasion. They speak a different language, worship a different god. Their hair is curlier, their noses are larger, their skin a bit darker. They have funny accents. They look like trouble. Isn't it interesting how history has a way of repeating itself, how the same negative stereotypes and wicked ways of looking at immigrants recur? And so the Egyptians enslave the Israelites, putting them to work as unpaid slave labor, building store cities, not pyramids, for the royal government. They set up overseers, taskmasters, establish work quotas, push the Israelites harder and harder, try, in fact, to work them to death. When that fails, the Hebrews turn out to be tougher than the Egyptians expect. They decide they'll just kill all the male babies, eliminate the whole masculine population in one generation. Ah, but the Jews are too crafty for their oppressors. In the tribe of Levi, a woman hides her newborn baby boy until his cries are too loud to be stifled. She puts him into a tiny ark, a new Noah, setting him a sail in the Nile River. And when the Pharaoh's daughter pulls him from the river and names him Moses, a remarkable story is truly begun. Shmot tells of the early life and adolescence of Moses, his instinctive outrage at injustice, his hot temper, his exile to the Sinai, It shows Moses mature, marry, father children in the desert. And then it takes him through the dramatic narrative of the burning bush, an encounter with the commanding God that will bring him back into the crucible of history and lead him to become the greatest liberator the world has ever known. Finally, it returns Moses to Egypt to meet his brother Aaron and shape his destiny and ours. There's almost too much in this one portion to grasp, encapsulating as it does so many of the formative tales of our people's religious history. Most importantly, unlike so many hero stories of other traditions, Exodus does not make Moses into a god or even into a perfect paragon. He's just a man, a great, flawed man, born into a conflict not of his own making, rising to greatness through trial and error, learning both how to follow God and how to lead people towards justice and freedom. It's a great story, but more than that, it's a powerful lesson. Moses became the model for every truly great leader thereafter because of this very humanity, his ability to empathize with the suffering of the downtrodden, to utilize the power of righteousness to accomplish everything. May we come to understand as well that we can accomplish great things too if we choose, in spite of our own imperfections and limitations. We too can successfully fight for justice, for freedom, and for truth. We return in a moment on to Jewish. Our guest, Israeli Ambassador to Azerbaijan, Ronan Krauss, discusses the strong and supportive relationship that the Jewish state has with this Shia Muslim nation and how it has continued to evolve positively when we come back in a moment on to Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
President Donald Trump repeated his claims that the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire plan is imminent, both before and after meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu last week in Florida. While progress on the U.S.-brokered ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel, completed in October, has been very slow, both Israel and Hamas accuse each other of failing to uphold the bargain, Trump appeared eager to find ways to speed the peace process while he stood beside Netanyahu last week. When asked by a reporter how quickly Trump hoped to move into phase two of the ceasefire plan, he replied, "Quickly as we can," before stipulating the next phase was contingent upon Hamas disarming. Later, when asked by another reporter whether the reconstruction of Gaza will begin before Hamas is disarmed, Trump replied, "I think it's going to begin pretty soon," adding that he and Netanyahu were looking forward to it. "Look what a mess it is. It's been a mess for centuries, really. It's been a mess for a long time. It seems to be born for that, but we're going to straighten it out," said Trump of Gaza. "We're already starting certain things. We're doing things for sanitary conditions and others, but Gaza's a tough place. You know the expression, it's a tough neighborhood. It's truly a tough neighborhood." At the press conference after the meeting, Trump said Hamas will be given a very short period of time to disarm. If they don't disarm as they agreed, they have to disarm within a fairly short period of time, withdrawing force, said Trump. Continued that the other countries who back the ceasefire deal will wipe Hamas out if the terror group does not disarm. Over 2 months after all 20 living hostages were finally returned by Hamas to Israel as part of the first phase of the ceasefire deal, the remains of one murdered hostage, Ron Gvili, remains in Gaza. Netanyahu also announced last week President Trump will receive the Israel Prize in 2026, marking the first time the award will ever be bestowed on a foreign leader. Trump was informed he won the prize during that meeting with Netanyahu at Mar-a-Lago, as the pair discussed plans to push the ceasefire in Gaza into its second phase. "For the first time in history of the State of Israel, the Israel Prize will be awarded to President Trump," said Israeli Education Minister Yoav Kish. "This is a historic decision expressing recognition of President Trump's extraordinary contribution and lasting impact on the Jewish people in Israel and around the world." On a call with Kish, Trump said the award was a great honor, adding that to be the first one outside of Israel is really something. While the prize has infrequently been awarded to non-Israeli citizens in its history, including Indian conductor Zubin Mehta in 1991, this did mark the first time a foreign leader will receive the accolade. The guidelines for the prize mandate candidates have to be Israeli citizens, with the exception of candidates for the Israel Prize for Diaspora Jewry
and/or for a special contribution to the Jewish people. Zubin Mehta was a longtime music director of the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Speaking next to Trump, Netanyahu said he will receive the award for his tremendous contributions to Israel and the Jewish people. President Trump has broken so many conventions to the surprise of people, and then they figure out, oh, well, maybe, you know, he was right after all, said Netanyahu. We decided to break a convention or create a new one to award the Israel Prize, which in almost our 80 years has never been awarded to a non-Israeli. We're going to award it this year to President Trump. Netanyahu added the award reflects the overwhelming sentiment of Israelis across the spectrum. They appreciate what you've done to help Israel, help our common battle against terrorists and those who would destroy our civilization, said Netanyahu. Trump has made no secret of coveting and appreciating prizes, having frequently said that he himself deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. And the activist group Stop Anti-Semitism has awarded conservative personality Tucker Carlson its ignominious honor of Anti-Semite of the Year, citing his frequent invocation of classic anti-Semitic stereotypes. The announcement comes while Carlson sits at the center of controversy on the American right about whether anti-Semites should be welcome in the Republican Party. Marks the second year in a row that Stop Anti-Semitism has selected a right-wing figure for this accolade, after years of giving the award to left-wingers. Tucker Carlson mainstreams anti-Semitism by platforming and praising Holocaust revisionists and Nazi apologists, all while hiding behind irony and plausible deniability, by legitimizing extremist voices and weaponizing conspiratorial imagery at a massive scale. Tucker Carlson has helped drag anti-Semitic ideas back into the mainstream. The finalists for Anti-Semite of the Year this year included pro-Palestinian celebrities Miss Rachel, Cynthia Nixon, and Marcia Cross, mixed martial arts athlete Holocaust denier Bryce Mitchell, a couple of personalities associated with the Young Turks left-wing network, social media personalities on both the far left and far right. Last year's Anti-Semite of the Year was the rabid conspiracy theorist Candace Owens, whose virulent right-wing anti-Semitism infuses every aspect of her despicable podcast and personality. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Ambassador Ronan Krauss, who's had a distinguished career in the Israeli Foreign Service. I want to talk a little bit about what that personal experience is like. He is the ambassador to Azerbaijan, which has become really an important ally and relationship within the Muslim world for Israel. So the evolution of that relationship we spoke about earlier in the show, today, in addition to all of the commercial relationships, as you mentioned, 60% or so of Israel's oil comes from Azerbaijan, moved into Turkey, and then through a pipeline to ships and then shipped to Israel. Azerbaijan plays a kind of intermediary role between Israel and the Muslim world at times, doesn't it?
Yes, in a sense, they do. And it started way back, centuries ago. The Jewish community which lives today in Azerbaijan has been living here for centuries. I'm talking about the mountain Jews, the right. local Jews,
right.
who have come to Azerbaijan, probably from Persia or from other areas in the region. Maybe some of them, the origins are from the Khuzari era. And they have settled in Azerbaijan and became part of its society. And the one unique thing that describes the way that the Jews have been integral part of the Azerbaijani society is the fact that they have never suffered any kind of anti-Semitism or discrimination. And I think that this has been a true and remarkable example of how a Muslim state country can treat not only the Jewish population, but any minority that have lived here with respect to their tradition, to their values, and to their way of life. And even today, 30,000 Jews are living in Azerbaijan, enjoying all the freedom and the capability to live their lives freely. They have synagogues who are operating here freely. They have schools, Jewish schools, who are educating their youngsters, and they can live, they can have kosher food, they can celebrate their holidays, and they are being accepted, honored, and hugged by the regime and the people, both at all times. And this is something that should be told to the world, because this is an example that unfortunately we see less and less in today's world. Unfortunately, we see the we're evident to events of which are not very comfortable for any Jew all around the world. Anti-Semitism is raising its ugly head, and we should praise and we should cherish countries like Azerbaijan, who have never allowed these kind of events to take place here.
You know, it's stunning. There had to be some country in the world that didn't have anti-Semitism. It turns out to be Azerbaijan. I mean, it's, you know, I joke about it. It's obviously not a funny subject, but boy, it is really stunning to come to a place in the Caucasus, which is, you know, not exactly famed for its Jewish diversity in our minds. The mountain Jews are quite a fascinating population. It seemed to me like many of them have moved to Baku, and there's perhaps a somewhat diminishing Jewish population in Azerbaijan overall. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, indeed, yes. Some of the communities that lived outside of Baku, villages which were considered to be Jewish, no longer have a Jewish presence, except of one unique place, which is called Krasna Slaboda, the Red Village, which is located next to the city of Guba. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hours drive from Baku. And this is an extremely unique place, because I think that that's the only village, or we even might call it a shteto, which all of its inhabitants are Jewish. And even though there are not many Jews who live there on a day-to-day basis, all the houses are owned by Jews, and they keep coming back to visit their ancestors, their lands and houses for the holidays, for Pesach, for Rosh Hashanah, and mainly for Tisha B'Av, because Tisha B'Av, according to the local tradition of the local Jews, this is the day that you come and you pay your respect at the cemeteries at your ancestors' graves.
Yeah,
this is an extremely unique place, and I definitely encourage anyone who comes to visit Azerbaijan not to skip this treasure and to go and visit the Krasna Slaboda. On top of that, I have to remind to mention the Jewish Azerbaijani Jewish diaspora that has moved from Azerbaijan mainly to Israel, but to many other places. You can also find Azerbaijani communities in the United States and in Russia. But in Israel today, we have a Jewish Azerbaijani diaspora, which contains between 70,000 to 100,000, and they have established organizations, and they keep their traditions and history, and even special language. The Jewish community, the mountain Jewish community, used to speak a very interesting and special and unique language of their own. It's called Juari, and they keep maintaining the knowledge and the experience in speaking in this language, and you can hear it both here in Baku, in Krasna Slaboda, and also in cities around Israel. And the Jewish diaspora, which is located in Israel, is actually another bridge, another connection, which continues to strengthen the relations between both countries.
Tell us a little bit about the transitions Azerbaijan has undergone. I was actually living in Israel when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I remember it was like every week another republic, you know, had freed itself from the Soviet domination, was declaring independence. They've gone in many different directions. Can you describe kind of briefly how Azerbaijan has gone?
So, as I mentioned before, at the beginning of the 90s, Azerbaijan was stepping out from the former Soviet Union, heading into a civil war with Armenia over Karabakh, and the situation and the level of life, the quality of life was quite low. But then slowly they have started to gain back their stability. The former president Haider Aliyev have signed in 1995, what they call the contract of the century, which allowed the development of the reservoirs, the oil reservoirs, which were found. Azerbaijan has been always an oil producer, but starting from the late 90s, they have become a leader, in a regional leader in production of oil, and a contract was signed, and the reservoirs were developed, and the pipeline which connects Baku through Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, to Ceyhan, which is a port in Turkey, while Turkey was established. And in 2005, the oil started to flow all the way from Baku to Ceyhan, more than 1,700 kilometers. And actually from Ceyhan, it makes its way to Israel by tanker to the port of Haifa. Now, starting from 2005, the economy started to develop. The money started to flow into Azerbaijan, and the country started to rebuild itself. The structures, the infrastructure, roads, tunnels, cities, the city of Baku started to grow. I actually had the pleasure of arriving to Azerbaijan for the first time in 2010 as deputy ambassador, and I remember seeing in front of my eyes during the 5 years that I spent here as deputy ambassador the development, the incredible development of the city of Baku. Sky-rises, buildings, hotels, international events that Baku has started to host, starting from the Eurovision, which they won in 2012, and the first European Olympic Games, which they hosted in 2015, and many more events which took place later on. The last one, just last year, they have hosted the COP29, and for each kind of this event, they built, they created, they continued to develop the country, and it is incredible to see the development which has occurred here in the last 10 years since I left in 2015. And one more incredible development which happened in 2020, and that was the war in which they regained the territories which they lost during the beginning of the 90s, the Karabakh territories, which were in the hands of Armenia. And in the last 5 years, what they have done was to develop that area as well. So if the Karabakh was basically ruined, nowadays they have paved hundreds of kilometers of roads, tunnels, bridges, railroads, at least three airports, international airports, and are now working also on the connectivity, which will connect Azerbaijan to the west via the Karabakh area, the what is called Zangezur, or the trip corridor into Nakhchivan, which is an enclave which belongs to Azerbaijan, and from then there to Turkey. And that will actually be a transport corridor which will connect Europe via Azerbaijan and the Caspian Sea to the east, to China.
It's incredible.
Incredible development, which has taken place in the last 20 years, and I believe that it will continue to grow and grow in the future.
I have to say, the only place that seems to build as much as Azerbaijan, in my experience, is Israel. There are many similarities. One of the keys, it seems to me, in the relationship between Azerbaijan and Israel, in addition to the absence of anti-Semitism and the pragmatism of the country, it's a secular Muslim country, 95% Muslim people, but the state does not advocate religion. It's been very particular about not allowing some of its neighbors to influence its educational system. Maybe you could talk about that just a little bit.
Yes, so this is actually one of the unique things about Azerbaijan, that they managed to maintain their identity with a lot of respect to their traditions. So although this is a Muslim country, there are influences which are coming from the neighboring country. But at the same time, as we said before, Azerbaijan maintains strategic relations with Israel. And this is something very unique, which proves that a country can maintain good relations with countries, other countries which might be in a state of war or non-friendly to each other. And in diplomacy, usually we call, or there is a terminology which is called the zero-sum game, meaning that if I'm a good friend of one, it means necessarily that I'm not very good friends with the other. But I think that Azerbaijan proves to us all that there is a way to maintain good relations even with enemies who do not have either diplomatic relation between them or that there is some tension between the two.
It's an extraordinary relationship. I note when we were there, everybody, yourself included, said if Azerbaijan were to fully join the Abraham Accords, it would be a step down in diplomatic relations because there's so much close relationship. The Azerbaijanian ambassador in Israel said the same thing to us, actually. I guess that's kind of true, isn't it?
Yes, yes. I think that there is a lot of truth in it. Since the relations are so developed and there is so much content into the relations, so the Abraham Accord, it's a nice framework. It's a positive a structure which relations between Israel and any other country which we do not have diplomatic relations could be based on. But since the relations between us and Azerbaijan have been around for more than 30 years and they are so rich, they are so well preserved, and they are full of content, and there is a constant dialogue between the two, so the Abraham Accord could be either a nice addition or something that could be added in. But it's not that if we will not have the Abraham Accords between Israel and Azerbaijan, it's not that we will lose anything from what is already in place. I encourage people to search, to read, to learn, and definitely to come and visit.
We will come back, and I want to bring my family and hopefully have the opportunity to see you again. Thank you. All the best. Kol tov.
Thank you very much.
Bevakasha. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Join us next week for another great edition of Two Jewish. Our guest will be Samantha Ellis, author of the Iraqi Jewish memoir, Always Carry Salt. Our playout this morning comes from the klezmer group called Jubilaya. My friends, have a great secular, nearly new year, a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
As the Rebbe singt, as the Rebbe singt, singen al Chassidim, singen al Chassidim.
Two Jewish is sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.